You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to a community-supported and guest-produced edition of the Best of the Left podcast, with clips today from The Young Turks, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, Ring of Fire, Le Show, and Democracy Now!
Okay, so that's late on the show, but first, we got big news for you guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
That is just that's as premature a "we got him" as has ever been uttered.
Well, look, we took a huge first step here, and a very important first step. FISA law that we've been talking about for so long that the president has been in violation of. The president has announced that he will finally submit to the actual FISA court and start to get warrants from here on out for it, looking into possible cases of terrorism, etc. So it appears, for the moment being, first, we're going to give you the 100 caveats in a second and the things that are about to come up, but it appears for the moment being the president has agreed to start following the law again. And that's why, if anything deserves it, we got it. It's not a "we got him," we got it in this case. This does, because this is enormous if it proves to be what they claim it is.
I couldn't be less moved by this piece of information.
Well, we tried. Oh, well, we didn't.
No, I mean,
didn't work.
The reason being, like, oh, wow, the president's going to follow the law? Well, wow, crazy.
Well, I mean,
who gives a flying F? Let's prosecute him, or let's hold him accountable for all the laws that he's broken up until now. I mean, that's the story.
Well, Jill has made a good point in what I think is missing another good point. But I think, first of all, this shows what can happen when there is political change.
That's definitely one of the themes I want to
get. I mean, it is good news that there was a law in the books that he ignored, and now it would appear, because he simply had all Democrats and many Republicans against him, was actually going to change. And Republicans now all of a sudden feeling free to say, "I always said you should follow the FISA law."
So, right. Right,
so but sure whatever, forget the hypocrisy. The important thing is that they follow the law and that we return to the rule of law. What I think Jill makes a great point is that our big celebration is a law that's been on the books since the late 70s that everyone has followed. This president broke and now is like, okay, I'll follow it. And we're like, yeah!
Uncle Melvin stopped molesting me. He's super! Yay! Wow, cool, I love you. Pat on the back.
All right. Well, look, let's get real here. First of all, I don't think
that Melvin stopped molesting.
I don't think we should hug Uncle Melvin, and I think we should look into prosecuting Uncle Melvin, and I love that analogy. So don't get me wrong. I'm not like, oh, Bush rocks now, right? And should the Democrats still have the investigators that they're going to have? Unquestionably. But what I'm celebrating today, and I think it is a real celebration, is obviously not what the Bush's actions or that Bush has given in. It's that what Ben Mankiewicz predicted a long time ago, that I believed and that I hoped for, but I wasn't positive about, the American system winning over this rogue administration is beginning to happen. And this is a very important step in that the system is bigger than these guys and the system's going to win. What happened was, the Democrats won control of Congress. I'll tell you the two very specific reasons why the Bush administration changed their mind and decided to follow the law going forward is, one, when the Democrats took control of Congress, and again, Ben and Michael and a lot of people on the show, and not that I disagree with this, of course, in any way, shape, or form, but they championed the idea that, look, you got to win first, and winning makes an enormous difference. And here's one of the ways that it does make a difference, and again, how Ben was right. Now that the Democrats control what hearings happen in the Senate, they had put together a hearing on what was happening with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA laws that we've been talking about, and this warrantless wiretapping. And Alberto Gonzalez is scheduled to come in front of that board
today.
Okay, so he's supposed to go there and he's supposed to answer questions, and he was in a bit of a panic over it, because he should be, because he's breaking the law. The president's breaking the law. They're breaking the law together. He doesn't have any good answers. And now, since the Democrats have taken over, he'll be under oath. He can't pull what he did with the Republicans, where Spector was like, oh, I really care about this, but just go ahead and lie if you want, because you're not under oath. So now he's going to be under oath. So what did he do? They pressed the panic button. They said, okay, fine, you win. So now Gonzalez will go for the hearings today, and he'll say, oh, what? Yeah, we're doing what you said. What? It's over. It's over. What are you talking about? It's moot. You don't even have to talk about it. We're doing what you said. The second thing that happened was a court in Cincinnati in Ohio said this program is illegal. You're breaking the law. And that's going to go to up. It's coming up for appeal very, very soon. And they knew they'd lose the appeal. So they're going to go to the court and say, illegal. It's moot. A court can't even consider this because we already changed it. So stop telling us what we're doing is illegal. So that's the both Congress and the judiciary, the other two branches, asserting their power over the executive and winning. Mm-hmm. And us getting back to a nation of laws rather than a nation of men. And that's a great sign for America. And I think today, and we'll get into the caveats in a second, but for that alone, today's a great day for America.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. God's gonna cut.
It was in December of last year that we first learned the president had authorized domestic spying by the National Security Agency. Tonight, at the start of this December, comes word that eavesdropping might be just the proverbial tip of the iceberg when it comes to the federal government's surveillance on its own citizens. It seems not being on the no-fly list is no longer enough to keep someone out of the clutches of the Bush administration. The Associated Press reporting that millions of American citizens entering or leaving the U.S. in the past 4 years have been assigned a secret terror rating based on such bizarre factors as number of one-way trips taken, seating preferences, dining preferences. It gets worse. Travelers are not allowed to see nor challenge the computer-generated scores, which the government plans to keep on file for up to 40 years. The Democrat Patrick Leahy, the incoming chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, today expressing outrage, promising scrutiny of the program in the new Congress. One can only imagine how outraged Senator Leahy might be at seeing this other thing, the kind of image taken by a new federal screening system, X-raying of passengers' bodies to detect concealed explosives and other weapons. That's apparently not all it can detect. The Transportation Security Administration planning to have one such machine up and running at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport by Christmas. If you have been roped into spending the holidays with the in-laws in Scottsdale, here is your perfect excuse. Or go Greyhound. For a constitutionality X-ray, I'm joined now by George Washington University law professor and constitutional law expert Jonathan Turley. Thanks once more for your time tonight, sir.
Thanks, Keith.
Having now seen that photo, we can't not begin with the X-ray machine. It would seem, Jonathan, to be not just intrusive, but actually indecent, so much so. What is the difference between requiring passengers to subject themselves to that and simply asking them to strip off all their clothes before boarding?
Well, maybe this is a recruiting tool to get TSA applicants, which will now be called TNA or something. I don't know. But most of us are more afraid we'll be sent to something like Jenny Craig than Gitmo after this, because it is a very revealing picture. picture. And, you know, on the serious side, you know, there is real problems with having strangers looking at an image, even one with parts covered up, that still is pretty accurate in terms of what you look like under your clothes. And the Constitution recognizes that there are some unreasonable searches and seizures. I would have to say that this seems pretty unreasonable. I think most people would be horrified. You know, we've all seen these people gathered around these screens looking at what's in your luggage. Sometimes it looks like a coffee clutch. I think people would be horrified to know that their actual physical image was on the machine.
Let's turn to this personal terror rating. I mean, it sounds terrible, but I'm having trouble nailing down what's particularly terrible about this. Is it the criteria? You know, when you use things like meal preference, that might be a kind of hidden racial or religious profiling, or if not that, what is the core problem with this plan?
Well, you know, I testified in Congress about the use of profiling in the airports, which I happen to support on a general level. But there are great dangers with profiling. One of them is obvious that it's been used for racial purposes, and it's been used improperly in the past. But also, it's something that is very easy to abuse. You know, we've seen in just normal profiling, people arrested when they're the first to get off a plane because they're in a hurry, or people arrested when they're last to get off the plane because why are you taking so long? Or holding back. And you can put enough innocuous items in there that it becomes ludicrous. And when you're looking at what people are ordering, I mean, do we really think that terrorists are going to order an appropriate religious meal? They're not looking for vegans. Obviously, the meal selection is probably geared a lot towards the Islamic faith. That's my guess.
Was the analyst who told the Associated Press, never before in American history has our government gotten into the business of creating mass risk assessment ratings on of its own citizens, correct when he then said that this was an unprecedented attack on the privacy of the average American?
Well, I think it's a significant attack on privacy. What bothers me the most is what Senator Leahy said, that he seems to have been in the dark about this. And once again, we see an administration that has this insatiable appetite for massive computer systems and keeping records on Americans and sort of codifying everyone's life. And repeatedly, Congress has told them they don't want these types of systems to exist. The fact that such a powerful senator seems to be taken unaware by this, I find quite shocking.
Lastly, there, as if we needed another issue, there's another privacy issue. Starting today, the U.S. companies also are required to store every email and every instant message and every electronic document created by their employees. Basically, if you say it, you write it, you type it, you expect your employer to keep it if you didn't already, but later they could possibly use it against you or someone could use it against you in a court of law. How concerned should we be about this as an invasion of privacy?
Well, all of these form a sort of mosaic. I mean, privacy is one of the things that has distinguished us as a nation. We have always had a far more robust idea of privacy than any other nation, and we're fast becoming a fishbowl society. We're losing privacy. We have far less privacy today than my grandparents had. And as you lose your privacy and your expectations of privacy, it changes who we are and creates chilling effects. And this is an example of that, where everything you write is going to be recorded and preserved in the sense that I'm under a microscope as a citizen. That's not healthy for a free society.
We need to have those emails free for other people to publish them on the Internet.
Right.
Jonathan Turley, the constitutional law expert, professor at George Washington University. As always, my friend, great thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Keith.
And when we've all had our fun, deflate the stars and put away the sun, and so we can call it a day.
Attack. Historians have been crystal clear about the fact that Nero sat idly by and watched Rome burn because Nero, you see, was as loony as a Daffy Duck. Most of that Nero lunacy came from the fact that he was so comfortable with his unchecked power that he routinely disregarded reality. Nero's history is one of a lunatic leader who rarely had a grasp on just how bad things around him really were. And those few George Bush supporters still kicking around with W stickers plastered on their Humvee windshields, those people still like to characterize that George Bush dementia as decisiveness and unwavering assuredness. It's no surprise because even as Nero played his lyre while Rome was engulfed in flames, he still had his own small gaggle of bent, moronic followers calling him Caesar. We got the first glimpse of the shrub's reality impairment September 11th, 2001, when little George continued to read My Pet Goat to school children, even after he had learned that our country was under attack by Islamic terrorists. His blindly loyal GOP androids told us back then that the shrub was taking a few minutes to think before he jumped on Air Force One and hid out like a scared school child for 2 days. But we should have recognized that the shrub was suffering from that Nero syndrome even back then. At the last State of the Union address, we all got another glimpse of how badly our own modern Nero suffers from reality disconnect when he failed to say a word about how four generals had pointed out that our military is stretched so thin that we're incapable of responding to a true military threat anywhere in the world. As I watched him bumble his way through that pathetic State of the Union address, it was clear to see that he had no connection at all with the painful suffering he had visited on so many families of American soldiers. It's as if he can't project himself into the homes of Iraqis where 150,000 innocent men, women, and children have died as a direct result of his endless stupidity. In that speech, words like global warming and energy dependence or corruption and affordable health care were all interspersed all around his unsophisticated, almost sophomoric address, but it was easy enough to look in his eyes and see that he still hasn't connected those dots because he truly does suffer from the Nero syndrome. And even as these words are spoken, our very own 2007 Nero could care less that almost 60% of the American public regard the shrub presidency as a complete failure. He doesn't really care that there are only 27% of the American public that still call themselves Bush automatons and approve of the job he's doing. And just like Nero, no doubt his eyes glaze over and a dimwit smile comes to his face when he was told that virtually every expert who has looked at the Iraqi war and its relationship to terrorism tells us that the shrub's civil war has dramatically increased the threat of real terrorism all over the world. You know, you can almost hear that demented voice somewhere in the dark corner of his mind, a voice that says, "Burn, baby, burn."
The PAP Attack on Air America Radio Network. Go to ringoffireradio.com or airamericaradio.com for more info.
Time won't save our souls. Time won't save our souls. Time won't save my soul, no.
I really encourage you all to communicate with the show, and there are lots of ways you can do it. You can join the community forum to speak with other listeners, leave comments on the show notes blog, send emails directly to me at hippiesympathizer@gmail.com, or have your voice heard by the entire audience by calling the comment line at 206-202-0195. Links to all of these at bestoftheleftpodcast.com.
Who knows if I'll see you again? Who knows if I'll see you again? One more for the soulmate dreamers. One more for the wicked man. One more for the peaceful protest that keeps the war in demand. Who knows if I'll see you again? Who knows if I'll see you again?
when Tim gets worked up, he lets it rip. And I say Tim, not Congressman Ryan, not because I'm flippant, but because Tim's kind of a young guy, and it sometimes, you know, he gets passionate, and I love it.
He's the co-leader of the 30-something caucus, the sort of young Democrats.
Yeah, and, you know, you're going to hear it just as fine on the radio. The one thing that you can see on theyoungturks.com as we play you the video is Tim is pointing throughout in a very aggressive manner.
He's a pointer.
And I loved it. So here's Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio.
On the floor of the House.
And then, on top of all that, they leave the new Democratic majority an absolute budget catastrophe for us to deal with. And over the course of those 14 years, the Republican Congress and the Republican president borrowed more money from foreign interests than all of the previous presidents combined. So now we're going to get lectures from the Republican majority on how to run the budget process. Now we're going to get lectures from the most incompetent, ineffective Congress in the history of this institution, Mr. Speaker. The history of this institution. And this party will not be lectured about veterans' benefits. We will not be lectured, too, by the Republican minority about how to balance a budget. And we will not be lectured to about investments in this country. You look at this CR and you look what we put in. We're not going to be lectured to by anybody. We've made promises and accomplished more in the last few hundred hours of this Congress than that Republican majority has in the last 14 years. We implemented PAYGO so we will balance the budget. We made some difficult decisions with the CR so we could move forward. And we're not going to be lectured to, because we've made promises and we've delivered. Now just look at the first 100 hours, Mr. Speaker. Just the first 100 hours. We cut student loan interest rates in half. Once fully implemented, we'll save the average person taking out a loan almost $5,000. We raised the minimum wage. We allowed the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate drug prices on behalf of the Medicare recipients. We repealed the corporate welfare to the energy companies that majority, Republican majority, put in place, and we're taking that money and investing it into alternative energy sources. We're doing things positive for the American people.
I love it. I can't get enough of it. When he says that Republican Congress, he points to the other side, and he's like, "We're not going to get lectured to by these guys who are the most incompetent Congress ever in here." I can't get enough of it.
No, apparently you can't.
I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me.
Joining us now is Sean Penn, Oscar-winning actor and one political activist who's not content to simply give speeches and join protest marches, although you did make a fantastic speech at the anti-war march in Washington last week. Sean also visited Iraq twice since 2002. And also Iran on his own initiative and as an occasional foreign correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. He got out in a boat and helped rescue victims of Hurricane Katrina And he recently called openly for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Sean, thanks so much for joining us on Ring of Fire.
Pleasure to be talking to you.
You gave this fantastic speech to the Creative Coalition. You won the Chris Reeve Award and gave a speech in which you called for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. That's something that we've talked about a lot on this show. And, you know, the reaction that we get to that, even from people, as you pointed out, like Frank Rich, is that, well, you know, it's time to move on. What do you think when people say that?
I think there's a kind of complacency, a kind of a reliance on status quo thinking that's largely generated by the movement of the Democratic Party right now. With the newfound Congress, I think that the issues are very clearly being addressed on the basis of a 2008 election. And I think as a sort of title page to that, the Hillary campaign is what's being centralized in the movement. So when we talk about things like cutting funding to the war, and without properly communicating to the American people that that should and must include some international security forces to do what can be done to prevent further bloodbaths in Iraq. Or when we talk about things like impeachment, the real protection of the Democratic Party is moving towards the center in the notion of not being not having the courage to be mavericks, and also not having the faith in the American people. And I think that's where the American people now have an opportunity and a real job to stand up with Congress, and because I think that in many corners of Congress, the pressure would be a welcome pressure. We see a new speaker in Pelosi who's taken both of those issues formally off the table, both a binding agreement to stop funding as well as the impeachment issue. And I think that in the precarious position she's in, the gamble is that common gamble of the past, which won't work today because people are dying today and it's time to do it now. But those things that the Congress might do won't work without the support of the people. So we're mutually reliant, and it's time for the people to, as I said in another speech, to be the deciders and to tell Congress what it is that we want to see done.
We're talking with Sean Penn on Ring of Fire. You know, I remember when Newt Gingrich, during the mid-80s, when Newt Gingrich kind of made himself a maverick in Congress, and he was hypercritical of the Democrats. He took a very kind of radical position, radical right-wing position, on all of these different issues, and he was being warned by moderates, by Republican moderates in the House, that the American people that he was going to alienate the American people with this kind of strong rhetoric. But in fact, because he said what he believed in, people wanted to follow him. And he was leading in a completely malevolent direction. But people want to follow somebody who have strong opinions, who have a strong, compelling vision, and are not scared to articulate it. And today it seems that many of the Democrats that we have in the House think that the only way to retain political power is through, you know, triangulation, by simply staying safely in the middle and doing their focus groups and their polling. And, you know, that's something that you've been outspoken about as well.
Well, I think that if history means something, and if we're going to go ahead and spend money to teach our children history, then our representatives ought to pay attention to it as well. On the political aspect of it, politically, the history of impeachment is that it has not done harm to the party that initiated the impeachment. In this situation, again, I think that what Newt Gingrich did, if anything, proves the kind of competing sensibilities of what the media advertises as the common feeling of the country versus what the common feeling of the country actually is. And it's really that I think that our representatives are as guilty of being told which direction to go in by the media as many people have in the past. But I think that with the population, it's changing. And the 400,000 to 500,000 people in the streets of Washington the other day attest to that.
You were critical also of Bill O'Reilly, of Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, for their war, for their role in the roll-up to the Iraq war. How do you think those people should be feeling now? And how? What should our reaction be to those, you know, to the people who were banging the drums for us to go into this war, but unwilling to fight it themselves?
Well, you know, it's almost at the point where I feel silly commenting on people that behave in the way that these people have, and so with really no understanding of what a democracy means. You know, I think in honoring the blood that has been shed in many wars for the freedoms of this country, if only the issue of free speech is not celebrated, then that is as singular an anti-American sentiment as can be expressed. And those people are there to quell free speech, and it is their intention to do so. So I really think that we should be paying more attention to the 400,000 people in the streets of Washington than to a few blowhards who are paid by multinational corporate interests to spew their poison.
Has your outspoken advocacy damaged your career at all?
You know, the plain and simple answer to that is that we wake up in the morning as Americans, each with our own opportunity to speak on our own level, whether it's to the person laying beside us in bed or to a country at large through the media. I've been given an opportunity that I am very appreciative of and also feel a great responsibility to. So, as I, you know, as waking up, I wake up as an American first, not as an actor first. So what the damage it does to my career is never going to touch the damage that these bombs and bullets are doing to the bodies of Americans and Iraqis. And so it's a very easy decision for me.
Hold it now!
There are three huge things you can do to help support the show, but they only take a few seconds. Leave us a great customer review in the iTunes Music Store, dig the show on dig.com, and every month you can vote for the best of the left at podcastalley.com. Find links to all three of these most important sites on the right-hand side at bestoftheleftpodcast.com. Thanks for your support.
Of a TV station, but look around, here go the sound of a record ball, boom and pound. When I shut them down, I shut them down,
shut them down,
Ladies and gentlemen, the response of Senator Joe Lieberman to the response of the federal government to what happened in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina last May was angry. He issued a blistering statement added to the Homeland Security Committee's report on Katrina. At that time, of course, he was a Democrat and in the minority. He accused the Bush administration of withholding details about what top officials were doing as the hurricane arrived and flooded most of New Orleans. At the time, he said the lack of information left critical questions about disaster preparedness and response unanswered. Quote, there are matters we could not fully explore because of agency and administration recalcitrance and, in some cases, intransigence, Lieberman wrote last year. Only through a thorough and comprehensive investigation of what went wrong could we be assured that the government we will know what steps are necessary to get it right the next time. And he was critical at the time of a decision by the then chairwoman of the committee, Susan Collins of Maine, not to issue subpoenas for that information. Well, now Joe Lieberman is chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, and holding a hearing in New Orleans this week to basically show New Orleanians' message, we care, the senator now says he doesn't want to issue subpoenas for the information that the administration still has not provided. Quote, the senator believes a more productive use of his time and that of his staff is to make sure legislative fixes are implemented to ensure that a response to a future catastrophe is better, says his staff. The senator feels the American public has already concluded the White House response was lacking. Rather than take on the White House and open an old fight, he believes he can be more productive by moving forward. Yes, we were told at the time, we don't want to, you know, it's too early for the blame game. Let's get this response going. Plenty of time later to fix blame. Well, now it's later. I think this is an approach that Senator Lieberman can take much farther.
Reality TV has just gone way beyond cops.
Oh, what do we have here?
Looks like a murder one. Two bodies.
Wouldn't that be a murder two?
Yeah, or two murder ones.
Okay. All right. Good.
What happens when a senator hits the mean streets? The bad guys get a one-way ticket to anywhere else.
So these are fingernail scrapings under this pestle's hammer.
Yeah, we can trace those.
Yeah, we could, but I don't think either of us wants a witch hunt.
Every fact's a clue. Every clue's a door.
Senator, we've got a positive DNA match on the hair samples. Mm. It's slam dunk time.
Yeah, but you know what? I think it's also time to look forward. Let's just make sure nobody with this DNA ever does this again.
No bones. Joe Lieberman and a team of real dedicated crime scene investigators tear up the town, but they never play the blame game. It's hard to point fingers when they call you No Bones. Fighting crime just got a whole lot realer on the new Fox Tuesday, right after whatever the hell else we can find.
Throw up your rock fist if you're feeling it when I drop this. Show them how we blow this pop. Let's make it hot. The shotgun with the body rock till the party stops. It's time to take it up a notch and keep it locked for all the headbangers in the parking lot. Here we come, if you're ready or not. No time to talk, cause we on the clock. Bringing that to your club. Let me show you where we coming from. It don't stop from LA to New York. Show me what you got now.
All I know is what it did take to make this. All I am is what it will take to break this. All I know is what it did take to make this. All I am is what it will take to break this.
Light it up now.
The 2007 Left Forum came to a close Sunday in New York City. Each spring, the forum convenes the largest gathering here in the country of the international left. With close to 100 panels, three major cultural events, the Left Forum brings together organizers and intellectuals from across the globe. One of those who spoke was professor, culture critic, social justice advocate Cornel West. He's been described as one of America's most vital and eloquent public intellectuals, a professor of religion and African-American studies at Princeton University. Professor West is a critic of culture, now analyst of postmodern art and philosophy, has written and co-authored many books on philosophy, race, and sociology. His most recent book is Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. He addressed a panel at the Left Forum. Cornel West began by talking about the status of the political left in 2007.
What does it really mean to be a leftist in the early part of the 21st century? What are we really talking about? And I can just be very candid with you. It means to have a certain kind of temperament, to make certain kinds of political and ethical choices, and to exercise certain analytical focuses and targeting on the catastrophic and the monstrous, the scandalous, the traumatic that are often hidden and concealed in the deodorized and manicured discourses of the mainstream. That's what it means to be a leftist. So let's just be clear about it. So that if you were concerned about structural violence, if you're concerned about exploitation at the workplace, if you're concerned about institutionalized contempt against gay brothers and lesbian sisters, if you're concerned about organized hatred against peoples of color, if you're concerned about the subordination of women, that's not cheap PC chit-chat. That is a calling that you're willing to fight against and try to understand the sources of that social misery at the structural and institutional level and at the existential and the personal level. That's what it means in part to be a leftist. That's why we choose to be certain kinds of human beings. That's why it's a calling, not a career. It's a vocation, not a profession. That's why you see these veterans still here year after year after year, because they are convinced they don't want to live in a world and they don't want to be human in such a way that they don't exercise their intellectual and political and social and cultural resources in some way to leave the world just a little better than it was when they entered. That's in part what it means to be a leftist.
You don't like the sound of the truth coming from my mouth. You say that I lack the proof. Well, baby, that might be so. I might get to the end of my life, find out everyone was lying. I don't think that I'm afraid anymore. Say that I would rather die than trying. Whoa, swing me way down south. Sing me something brave from your mouth, and I'll bring you pearls of water on my hips, and the love in my lips, all the love from my lips. It's time when he swung the bat, and I found myself.
The Pap Attack.
You know, big tent politics is usually a good idea because it's politics of inclusion. The Democrats are consumed with big tent issues as a way to kick off their congressional agenda in 07. And, you know, in the long run, issues like drug price control, minimum wage reform, a better availability for college loans and lobby reform, all these are the kinds of big tent issues that separate progressives from the corporatist lapdog GOP that's plagued America for six dismal years. But I'm afraid the Madison Avenue political handlers are again giving progressive leadership bad advice by telling them to forgive and forget 6 years of GOP political strong-arming, 6 years of GOP's arrogant disregard for democracy and decency. And, well, you know, maybe we ought to just move on with a positive agenda. Let's all just make nice. Well, Democratic leadership needs to understand that most of the voters who put him back in control don't want to just make nice and move on to a compromised politics as usual. They're not interested in that. Democrats are in power because the American public, by an overwhelming polling margin, believe that the GOP is systemically, institutionally dishonest and corrupt. The polling prior to the November election showed that a strong majority of Americans view the new GOP as a party of ruthless, phony, fraudulent cheats who can't be trusted to run government with any modicum of integrity. Democrat leadership needs to focus on the fact that, yes, big tent politics is important, but good government, good social reengineering, and solid, important legislation can continue to take place at the same time that indictments are served, the same time that investigations are concluded, and political criminals are hauled off to jail. So before Democratic leadership joins hands around the campfire and sings kumbaya with the GOP leadership thugs, they need to remember this, that a huge number of voters went to the polls so they could finally have some questions answered about things like our war based on lies. They wanted to know how it is that the GOP engineered a government in just 6 years that illegally wiretapped our phones, illegally read our mail, monitored our personal computers, conducted searches and seizures of our home without without a warrant. A huge number of voters want investigations and, yes, maybe even indictments to flow out of Dick Cheney's secret sweetheart love fest with Enron, Exxon, and virtually every segment of an energy industry that pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into the grand old party in the last 10 years. They want to know, what did Shifty Dick give away? What did he promise in those meetings? Those voters that went to the polls in November are interested to know more about Cheney, Halliburton, no-bid contract giveaways in Iraq. Those voters want to understand how much participation this administration had in allowing the oil industry to price gouge every American for an entire 2 years without any action from the GOP Congress. And you know what? Those are just a few of the answers most voters want about what the grand old party and their shrub have been doing behind closed doors, unchecked for the last 6 years. So yes, go ahead and build a big tent. That's a good idea. Include everyone. Make America a better place to live. But don't do this. Don't ignore the obvious. Progressives are not ready to make nice yet. You need to remember that.
The Pap Attack on Air America Radio Network.
This show is produced with the help of the members of the Best of the Left community. You too can be a part of the show, and we would love your help. You can submit information about great clips you've heard, volunteer to help edit these clips for the show, or actually become an occasional guest producer. For more information, please visit the community at bestoftheleftpodcast.com.
Press conference where they're asking him, hey, what if they cut off the funding? What, you know, it seems like there's a lot of opposition to this escalation idea, yada, yada, yada. And he's batting them away left and right, going, we don't care, we don't care. The president's going to do whatever he's going to do anyway. But here's the killer line in it. Quote, the president has the ability to exercise his own authority if he thinks Congress has voted the wrong way. Okay, get a load of that quote. You know what that means? That means, not only do we not care how Congress votes, but we're actively not going to listen to them. That's the kind of quote that leads to constitutional crisis.
Read the quote again.
The president has the ability to exercise...
Oh, okay, yeah, that's the one I'm looking at right here. Yeah, it's a stunning freaking quote. I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
The president has the ability to exercise his own authority if he thinks Congress has voted the wrong way.
No, he doesn't.
No, you see, the Congress has voted. He doesn't have the right to say, well, I think Congress voted the wrong way.
What's the
so
point
I'm
of
just
going
to do it.
What is the point of having Congress anymore? I mean, if you had to ask President Bush or even Tony Snow at this point, then what is the purpose of Congress anymore?
Why?
If they are not there to put the president in check, if they're not there to help balance out the three branches of government, what are they there for? Why don't you just do everything yourself, President Bush?
The next question ought to be, sort of online of what Jill's saying, but very reasonable. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to raise your voice. You don't have to do anything. You'd be like, oh, all right. What's the point of Congress?
Like what I just said.
Right. But I mean, that should be asked of Tony Snow. I just mean, because I necessarily want to make some political zinger there with him. I'd like him to explain it, you know, and then once he explains it, you're like, but if the president disagrees, he can just ignore it. Does it seem to you then that Congress is sort of rendered powerless? Is there no reason to have them? Or are they like the British House of Lords? Would they largely be ceremonial?
And then then I would get antagonistic and I would say, do you think George Bush is a king? Because a king can ignore Congress. A president can't ignore. A president can't say that he'll exercise his authority even if he thinks Congress has voted the wrong way. I don't give a damn what you think if Congress has voted the wrong way. They voted. You got to listen to them. That's the whole constitutional system. It's called America. What happens when an executive exercises authority, even though Congress has prohibited it, is that's a dictatorship. That's a monarchy. That's an authoritarian or totalitarian government.
I don't know. Now, I didn't see the whole press conference. We're reading excerpts from it here. But it is, isn't it? Would it not be fair to say to Tony Snow, was Iran-Contra a scandal?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Reagan broke the law when they ignored the Boland Amendment? Or do you think he had the right to ignore the Boland Amendment because he disagreed with it? You know, because that is exactly the same kind of situation. No, national security. We need to get money to the Contras. This is how we're going to do it.
So I have to start right off today and say that this episode was produced by our brand new producer, Brian, and he claims to have no previous audio editing experience of any kind. So it leads you to believe that his first attempt at any kind of audio editing is the show you just heard. And, I mean, I wouldn't have believed it unless he told me, and I'm really not sure I do anyways, because I really just can't overemphasize what a phenomenal job I think he did. So huge thanks to him, and I sincerely hope to hear, you know, lots more of his work as the show goes on. Aside from that, I'm very encouraged since the last episode or two, we've gotten, you know, more people involved in the community. Things are definitely looking up. I just wanted to mention a couple of new faces. Frank and Al have been sending in some clips. Great to hear from you guys. Hold tight. All those clips will show up in later episodes. Brian himself also sending in clips. And a couple of old show favorites who don't get mentioned as often as they deserve. Eleanor and Mindy, both longtime members of the community who contribute more often than they are mentioned. So things are really looking good. I'm really liking how things are going. So you're wondering, if things are going so well, why hasn't there been a show in a week and a half? I know. I hear you. You may recall from the previous episode that my landlord also happens to be my mother's hero. And so last week was the week that she took the opportunity to visit, quote-unquote, me, and also, you know, get her books signed by the author and things like that, as well as come down to D.C. for the Cherry Blossom Festival. So I pretty much spent the whole week playing a tour guide in this city that I essentially know nothing about, so I was basically a tourist myself, and just had a tiny bit more knowledge of how to get around than everyone else. So so that's how I spent the last week or so, and so I certainly hope the show will get back on track. And today, actually, just as I was putting the show together, I noticed a new glowing yet scathing review of the show on iTunes that was essentially implying that ever since the show became community supported, it is more unreliable. You know, I guess implying that, you know, if I have to depend on other people to help out with the show, then it doesn't get done as well, and or it can't be done as often, something along those lines. And although that makes all the sense in the world, it's actually not the case. It's really just my fault. The community is actually way ahead of me most of the time. You know, they're sending in more clips than I can handle sometimes, and people are helping in all kinds of ways. And usually, seriously, more often than not, the big roadblock is me, not them. So I'm hoping to overcome some of those things, and of course, the more help, the better. So, as I say, things are going very well, but I certainly encourage all of you to get involved. You can do that at bestoftheleftpodcast.com, find the community, or as Brian did, essentially just emailed and said, hey, you know, you said you wanted help producing and to email you, so here I am. And so he dove right in. Anyone else out there who feels the same way, I think as much as I can say it, Brian really showed it. Like, with no previous experience, he dove right in and did a fantastic job, and that's exactly the kind of help that is going to keep the show going, and almost more importantly, because the show's not going to die, but making it a more regular thing, you know, keeping the topics fresh, etc., is really important, obviously, in a political world where news moves fast, so I hope that things are able to pick up that way. Besides all of that, there's lots of ways to support the show and contact the show, etc. I encourage you to do all of that. Check out the website, bestoftheleftpodcast.com. There's a whole tab dedicated to all the different ways to support the show. Most of them take almost zero effort or time, but they actually make a big difference. So check all that out, and that will do it for today. So from inside the Beltway, yet outside the border of Washington, D.C., I'm Jay, and stay tuned for more from the Best of the Left.
Thought by itself, black and white, you took apart a picture that wasn't right.